is the Financial Sense News Hour with the president of PFS Group, Jim Poplava. Since 1982, PFS Group has offered asset management and educational resources that have helped investors build, maintain, and preserve their wealth. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Well, some good news and some bad news. Things look a little better this week. We had oil prices back over $30 a barrel, and we've got OPEC talking among itself, hey, maybe we need to cut back on stuff. And of course, anytime the price of oil rises, that's been good for the stock market. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Up in hour one, Dave Nikoski from Vermilion Research will be with us. Dave is still playing the defensive side, but he's also got five things he's looking for to determine whether we're close to reaching a market bottom and could see or experience a substantial rally. You're going to want to hear what he has to say about that. And then also Ryan Poplava will be here to talk about what moved the markets this week. And finally, Greg Weldon will be here to talk about a lot of things in the commodity markets. All of that coming up in hour one.
And I'm John Loeffler. In hour two, you know, if you've listened to this program over the past 5 years, you know that the program has been a big advocate of dividend paying stocks. And if you've invested in high quality dividend stocks, you've actually done well. The question is, does that strategy still hold up? And if so, are there some caveats now? Do you have to be careful of certain factors when investing in these dividend paying stocks in the new environment? That'll be the first part of the big picture. And I'm sure it isn't any secret to you that the U.S. is right in the middle of a presidential election. We always call it silly season here on the program because of all of the silly season things people say about each other. And then all of a sudden they unite to form a common front against the opposite candidate after they've gotten through chewing each other up. It's a time when politicians kiss babies and do all the sorts of stuff they do. But unfortunately, the views that are prevailing in many of the debates are making Wall Street very nervous because they're not quite sure which way things are going as everybody's watching this national debt come close to $20 trillion. My, my, what is a person to do? Well, that's what we'll talk about all today on The Big Picture. Now, let's take a look at what's going on Wall Street. Ryan Poplava, the spark that ignited last week really continues to flame the stock market rally right now. The S&P closed up 2.8% this week for a total of about 6% off our low. That was back in February 11th of 1810. And when we last left off, there were some rumors of a production agreement by OPEC that helped to support the price of oil, right as key equity indices were testing the January lows. And those lows held. Oil rallied, and that was the spark. And since then, we had the retail sales figures you talked about last week and some insider purchases in bank stocks, the good kind led by CEO Jamie Dimon of JP Morgan. So it's been a busy, busy week. So tell us this week, what's helped to fan the flames of the rally?
Well, John, it's that statement that bad is good. Literally, there were some really bad numbers out of China over the weekend and then Japan early in the week. So China, they announced that their exports were down 11% and their imports were down 18.8% year over year. Japan over there, we saw a pretty bad GDP report, essentially a negative annualized. However, the interesting thing enough is that their market rocketed higher on Monday, about 7.2%, really in response to some rumors about pension funds boosting their equity allocations just based on rates being negative in treasuries and then also in the banks. And also just in response to the rally on Friday in the U.S. market. So, you know, their markets were closed when we started rallying off of our retail sales figures and among other things. You recall last week was one of the worst weeks for losses in Japan. The Nikkei was down, I think, like 11%. And conditions were oversold. And you know, it was definitely due a bounce. But essentially, there's this belief that central banks will do more. So any kind of bad numbers are going to be backstopped by the central banks. Our economic results this week, John, weren't really much to celebrate either. But we held up really well, given, you know, a negative Empire Manufacturing Survey, a negative Philly Fed survey. You know, both of those, our first real view on what's going on in February. However, It's never what the news is, it's how the market reacts to the news. Both numbers for the Empire Manufacturing, the Philadelphia Fed, were actually better numbers than in January. So a slight change there, and the market responded positively on those. It was also announced, John, that housing starts have dropped by an annualized 3.8%. So it's not very great economic numbers here, but here we held up. And the market didn't seem too phased by those announcements, as we had a lot of Fed officials this week. And I think at the end of last week, we had some comments by some Fed officials that really, you know, they're trying to calm things down and reassure markets that, you know, they're supportive of conditions. And, you know, just outright, James Bullard had said, you know, he's the St. Louis Fed governor. He's a voter currently. And he's also considered a Fed hawk. He said that conditions in the credit markets have tightened and falling inflation expectations. Both of those are reasons to be patient. And a couple other Fed officials said they can be patient for a long time. So that was enough to kind of fan the flame. We also did get some positive economic numbers. Not everything was negative. The industrial production number was better, and some of those have helped the market.
You know, I always wonder if the market, say, for example, something might really cause a flurry in the market on one day, if there's something bigger to distract it elsewhere, it sort of ignores what otherwise would cause a reaction.
Yeah, I think that's a political type thing to do.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I'm thinking. And I'm sure if you really wanted to get some kind of a market outcome, you could actually time it like that to make sure everything goes in the right flow. Okay, let's look at oil. Now, wasn't there an agreement to curb production finally from OPEC? There's a lot of talk about negotiations, say, between the Saudis and the Russians and all of this sort of stuff. Did stable oil prices help fan the flame this week?
Yeah, so as we've been talking over the past few weeks, there's been a lot of rumors, a lot of debate, and really nothing official. Finally, we did get that this week. And that did help, but not to the extent that the market and investors and speculators really wanted. You know, the main driver, I think, this week with the market rallying continues to be technically based. As you said, we hit lows last week and then rebounded. But it's also the official statement came out on, I believe, Tuesday from Saudi Arabia, Russia, Qatar, and Venezuela. They said that those nations plan to freeze January's production level. So not necessarily cut. Everyone wanted to hear cut. Just like if you recall in December with the central banks that met Europe and Japan, we wanted to hear that they were going to increase their monthly purchases of assets. They merely just extended the duration, and then the market was very much underwhelmed. So I think the market was underwhelmed slightly on this whole idea that they're going to freeze production. I mean, oil prices did rise this week. They did stabilize, but I don't think many investors in that area speculate that oil prices are going to skyrocket from here based on just a freeze. So, you know, this may support prices between maybe $30 and $40 near term, but I think, you know, a lot of the concerns in the energy area is not necessarily price right now. It's been in the balance sheets of a lot of these energy companies.
You know, it was interesting this week. David Stockman was on CNBC, and he was formerly the director of the Office of Management and Budget during the Reagan administration. He was basically saying we're sort of looking into the recessionary abyss, and we're hearing this talk more and more, even on some of the guests that Jim's having here on the program. Do you think the drivers this week are enough to lift the market out of just this correction and bear market in some cases? Or is this going to be a flash, a fizzle, and we're going to continue on in our pessimistic mood?
That's the big debate, John. And Chris, my brother, was just conversing with Felix Zuloff about this particular thing, because a lot of our traditional indicators that we follow here are not saying, hey, alert, alert, recession. Probabilities have increased about a recession. What is officially a recession? You know, a lot of those things, you know, Felix was saying that he doesn't think this is going to be a traditional recession, that things are different. He said he saw the huge capital inflows into China and emerging markets just in general. That was the big secular kind of bull market over the past 10 years. And now, you know, we're over the hill on that, and capital outflows are the conditions presently. So, you know, it's tough to say, as we have seasonally seen, you know, just talking about economics right now, weather conditions typically improve, obviously, once winter is over. And that's what we have seen over the last 2 years, which weather was a huge issue and catalyst between some of the negative economic numbers we saw in the first quarter of the previous 2 years. And then, like I said, we typically see surprises in those economic indicators going forward. There's obviously a lot of negative sentiment right now. You see that both in economic estimates as well as just overall sentiment on the market in general. That feeds on each other. Analysts, we all over extrapolate trends. So it's very possible that economic conditions can improve here over the next couple of months. But obviously, I don't think that that is going to really fix some of the structural problems with the markets, both financially and structurally with economies right now. I'd say that it's badly needed at this time that we see some of those economic numbers improve. Employment continues to be strong. CPI figures like the one we saw this week highlight that core prices do continue to rise. Investors might not get that long pause that we're currently really hoping for from the Fed, that the Fed officials are really on the loudspeker this week, concerning. The main issue continues to be the drastic gap between where investors see where rates are going to be in the future. We see that through the Fed funds futures and the Fed's estimates themselves, which we'll get finally an update next month. That'll be a real important catalyst to watch. If that gap narrows next month, that could be the catalyst for, I would say, risk appetites to improve. The warning I also want to leave, I guess, on the table short term is that credit market conditions didn't improve much this week. Even though we saw just a drastic rally in equities, like you said, about 6% off the lows, you look at gold, you look at bond prices, they're not down by much this week. Both of those had huge moves in February, and they're not giving much of that back. That to me is warning that many still don't believe in this rally. I've looked at volume, doesn't really support this rally either. Not a lot of conviction. I think it's just been an absence of sellers and maybe buyers renting. Credit default swaps are still elevated. That gives us an idea of credit conditions are still worrisome. Look at Devon's announcement this week, cutting dividends, cutting spending, and cutting employees. That's not productive, although that does create profitability, which we tend to see towards the end of cycles. The risk in energy isn't in the price, like I said, but really in the balance sheets. How many can keep producing to maintain their dividends when their hedges give way or their costs are higher than revenues in current conditions? ExxonMobil, my brother and I, we were looking at it, 75% payout ratio on dividends. And they are the poster child for conservative in the industry. I can remember looking at it just 6 months ago, it was at 30%. So again, like I said, I think concerns are shifting from price. Yes, price may be stabilizing here, but now I think concerns are on the balance sheet.
You're right. Things do tend to go in cycles. And a lot of times when you're at different points on the cycles or the trends, you tend to take the point where you are and extrapolate it to infinity, rather than realizing that other changes will come in. And at the same time, how could anyone believe that really conditions could have improved terrifically over the course of 1 week? Because a Fed pausing isn't going to weaken the dollar greatly, which would help earnings for the large multinationals or exports. And OPEC freezing production isn't really going to greatly help the profitability of the energy company. So, these are bumps on the road, so to speak.
You summed it up perfectly, John. And, those were the major drivers between weakness in S&P earnings last year, strong dollar, weak oil prices. And have we seen a real change in that yet? No. And on top of that, like I said, we've got credit conditions, which have worsened. The other item is European capitalization. Even though the ECB's Mario Draghi was out this week trying to calm markets as well, talking about banks sufficiently capitalized, credit default swaps, like I said, are elevated for Portugal and Italy on their sovereign debt. And per usual, central banks are obviously ready to do more. However, the OECD, which gave its growth outlook for 2016 this week, said that it's going to be an equal growth rate as of last year. No real change. And they're calling for and asking for fiscal stimulus. So I haven't seen any nation really making any outright promises other than obviously Japan. And even there, Abe's measures, how much have they helped? I don't know. It's hard to quantify given their GDP continues to fall. They've got now negative bank rates, negative Japanese government bond rates. The Diet there is still deliberating the 2016 budget. There is some hope that there's going to be maybe a package, another one but I think the earliest is possibly May at this point.
Well, the big thing is the central banks. You heard some people saying the end is near for the European banks. I'm not sure that's necessarily true. But on the other hand, if you look at it, the central banks are trying everything they can. They've got negative interest rates, which usually is a sign of some form of desperation. In my mind, they're doing bond purchases, pausing, margin changes. And right now, nothing really seems to stick. And as you said, Japan has a negative GDP.
Yeah, there's still some positives out there, but as we've stated, myself and Jim, the credit markets look concerned, even though we don't have, like I said earlier in the show, the traditional indications yet of a recession. We've got the financial conditions of stress, and we've seen that in 2011, saw it in 2012. The market bounced back. You know why? We had liquidity back then. We had the Fed, we had the QE programs, we had the ECB and its long-term refinancing operations. We had central banks on pedal to the metal, essentially, to assist in accommodation. And I don't think we have that. As I said, with the Fed, they've removed those purchases. We've been actually tightening conditions for the past couple of years. So we don't have that buffer like we did on these financial stresses before. So things are definitely different in that sense now than they were. But I think if you get a big statement out of the G20, like a Basel Accord, like agreement regarding currencies, bank capital, obviously more official comments from OPEC on oil production, a specific production cut, you know, those are the kinds of catalysts that are the bazookas that could really, I think, improve conditions. I don't think we're there yet. I think possibly maybe the Fed doesn't think that we're there yet. Other central banks, fiscal stimulus from governments, we're not quite there at the crisis level that they would need to start actually doing something and getting some changes made. And I apologize, John, and our listeners, if I sound like the glass is half full. Normally, you know, in previous corrections, I've been a lot more optimistic given conditions, given the central bank at the time. We are clearly in an earnings recession. I think that can't be argued. And the dollar and oil are what brought us there. Those are the two drivers. They haven't been fixed. That may be why, you know, we haven't seen gold or bonds sell off this week like they should. If this truly is, John, the rally and bottom that many think it may be.
And as we head into the weekend here and then into next week, obviously these economic announcements and developments are going to require some monitoring on your part, I guess, and you will promulgate those to us next week on the program. We'll see if there's any improvement. So, Ryan Poplava, appreciate it.
No problem. We'll talk to you then.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
Well, for investors, another frustrating year in 2016. Stocks up one week only to fall the next. And as we look at all sectors across asset classes, outside of bonds, everything seems to be heading south. Joining us on the program is Dave Nikoski from Vermilion Research. Dave, let's talk about where the market is right now. We're doing this interview on a Thursday. Stocks are rallying to some degree. Is this just a bear market rally in your opinion, or could this be the start of something good?
Hi, Jim. Thanks for having me on. You know, I think it's what we need to see in the market. And I guess we look at the market currently that we're still not in the start of a bull market, and we really need to see some changes take place in a number of areas within the market to give us greater belief that we truly are making a reversal here. It's going to take a while to repair the damage. I think we've lost a lot of investors in this. The volatility has certainly, I think, pushed a lot of investors to the sidelines. And usually when you have this type of apathy in the market, it takes a while to rebuild it. And I'm not sure that investors right now really have the belief that we're seeing out of the Fed in terms of them doing the right actions, as well as what we see overseas. So there's a number of things that really need to take place to turn this market.
When you see these rallies, as we're seeing right now, one of the things that we have seen since we had that steep decline beginning at the end of the year and the first of the year is we've had several rally attempts, but they haven't held. In fact, we're getting close to a level where in the past, the market turned south again. Are you seeing weakness, or you're seeing any strength behind these moves?
Well, I think to a degree, we're actually seeing a number of items in terms of individual stocks that certainly look like they've bottomed or at least positively inflecting versus the market. And that's typically what we're going to see during a reversal, is we're going to see a number of names that just stand out. And some of these names that we're seeing, you know, whether it's Coach or Mattel, to name a few, Michael Kors, Vera Bradley, what we want to see as technicians, at least in our office, is we want to see, you know, some of the consumer stocks muster out some reversals. However, there's far too many that are still in downtrends and damage that it will take time. And whether over that time we see another 10 to 20% drop in the market is certainly not a question that we can definitively answer in terms of the percentage drop, but we need to see some bottoming patterns, whether 10% lower or 20% lower. And just having a handful of stocks that are starting to perk their heads up is certainly a welcome sight to us. The question is how long will these last? And again, I think we need a coordinated effort in terms of what sectors we see as leadership and which ones that we begin to see break down. We'd like to see money come out of the staples and the utilities where we've been overweight them for a while. And we want to see it, you know, reversals in technology. We want to see reversals or at least stabilization in the commodities and the banks. And I think right now when we're looking at the market, we're just not seeing a degree or certainty in terms of the banks making a bottom. And I think historically, when you look at the financial sector, you know, that is telling you the health of the economy. And unless we can perhaps push crude up more, you know, I think you could probably start, you know, removing some of the defaults off the table in terms of what energy companies' damage would cause the financials. In other words, if we can move oil up, I think that many of your banks, some of that default concerns are going to start coming off their books. And I think that's what the market's pricing in right now with the financials.
You know, you mentioned in a recent piece that you've seen some short-term improvements in down-and-out sectors like materials, especially the precious metal miners. And Dave, also, it's amazing with oil hovering around $30 a barrel, it doesn't seem like the oil stocks are plunging like they were in the past when there's bad news. Either the deal between Russia and Saudi Arabia wasn't what everybody thought it was. You just don't see the oil stocks plunging like you used to. Is that an encouraging sign to you?
It's an encouraging sign. I think for most of the energy sector, the strength that you've seen within the sector has been relegated to the major oil companies in terms of their relative performance, whether it's Exxon, Chevron, or Conoco. I think part of that is investors are seeking liquidity, and those are three names that you can move in and out very easily in terms of their trading volume. Historically, you know, what you want to see is you want to see the small caps, mid caps come off the floor to indicate that, you know, investors really are willing to take the risk at these prices to move them up. So I wouldn't be on the edge saying, you know, you just have to start loading up on energy. I guess I look at the sector as an insurance policy. It's become such a very small weighting in the market over the last 18 months that now you need to own it for insurance, because no one's going to call the very bottom. No one's going to call the very top. If you think we're seeing some stability, you have to own something in there. And again, you're better off owning them when they're down and out. And, you know, they could have a 30% rally on many stocks and still not break the downtrend. And the question is do you want to insure yourself against missing out on that 30% rally?
Let's talk about a sector that you highlighted in a recent piece of yours, and that has been sort of the breakout of a downtrend in not only gold, but also the gold miners ETF, GDX. Well, let's talk about that. What's that telling you?
Well, it's telling us that our investors are definitely in a mode of panic. I guess we question the longevity of such a rally out of the miners. However, there's a number of miners that are truly breaking out, and some of them to all-time highs, believe it or not. I was looking at Franco Nevada out of Canada this morning, and you're breaking out to historical highs. I've seen a lot of great positive inflections. I think there would be higher credence to the move that we're seeing if we saw a decline in the U.S. dollar. The U.S. dollar is holding in there steady. I do believe that a decline in the U.S. dollar would actually elevate all the markets around the world. And historically, that has been the case. When you look at foreign markets in U.S. dollar terms, we look back at 2008, 2009, and we indeed, I think it was 28 out of 30 markets that we looked at that were significantly higher 1 year out from that March 6th, March 9th low of 2009. But what you're seeing right now is investors are hiding in the dollar as we're the, on a relative basis, the best economy in the world still. And again, I think you could take the world out of a global recession. If we just saw, you know, the dollar break down below 93, I think you would send foreign markets much higher.
So in this kind of trade where you're seeing gold and, let's say, the dollar and treasuries rally, it seems like those were the best. But that indicates to me investors are worried about some kind of financial crisis, liquidity crisis or something. If I'm in the dollar, I'm in treasuries, I'm buying gold, I'm not thinking about good times ahead.
Exactly. You know, and some of the other items that I would look at and, you know, that we're keeping in front of us is, you know, looking at things like the TED spread and the U.S. overnight repo rate. Both of them moved up substantially. The TED spread's coming down now. I think that's something that we definitely need to see. The repo rate is still elevated, so that is telling you that there is certainly some credit risk in the market. Banks are just unwilling to have overnight loans sitting out there with other banks. The TED spread's indicating that, you know, Europe, the spread between LIBOR and treasuries at a high level would indicate that the financials overseas, there's a great degree of risk in them. So, you know, if these two can come back down into kind of a normalized area that we've seen over the last, you know, 5 years, that would certainly make us much more comfortable looking at the markets in terms of them bottoming, because I think you would remove a lot of that credit risk.
So two things for improvement. Let's say the price of oil stabilized and even rose and the dollar fell. That would bring a lot of improvement not only to the overseas markets, but I would also think too, Dave, it would help the U.S. with a lot of corporations and the S&P 500 and the Dow international companies. So dollar rising overseas has not been good to profits or exports.
That is absolutely correct. And, you know, what's interesting is the dollar peaked out on March 6th of 2009. 3 days later, you made a market bottom. If you looked at the technicals of that particular chart, you would see that you were actually breaking the uptrend. So what we have right now is we have investors, you know, seeking liquidity in terms of currencies, which is the U.S. dollar. That's also a fear. Even during the meltdown during the late 08 and early 09, the U.S. dollar actually saw a very, very surprising rally in it, despite, you know, what was happening in Lehman Brothers and Bear Stearns. But again, we were the best of the worst. And I think that we're just seeing a lot of investors fearful. And when we see money start to come out of the dollar, I think you're really seeing investors making a bet on other markets that they're near their floor.
Yeah, because when you take a look at the various sectors in the S&P, you've got an overweight on consumer staples. You have an overweight on utilities, market weight on technology. But just about every other sector within the S&P outside of, let's say, financials, which you have market weight, is underweight. So it sounds to me like you're favoring more still sticking with the defensive side of if you're going to be in the market.
That is correct.
So if we look at a change, we talked about maybe if oil prices stabilized, the dollar was to weaken. In your recent analysis, you talked about five factors you'd like to see change. I wonder if you can hit each one of them. One was a reversal of the breakdown of the major indexes like the S&P or the Russell, a breakdown in defensive sectors' relative strength, strength in consumer discretionary, a recovery in financials, and a stabilization in foreign markets. Let's begin with the reversal of the breakdown of major indices.
Yeah, one of the things that indicated that we were seeing some breadth deterioration in the market for quite some time was looking at the S&P 500 on weighted. Here at Vermilion, we do a lot of sector and group work. We do it on a weighted and unweighted basis, and you saw a substantial deterioration in the breadth back in June, July of last year. What we really want to see is we want to see a reversal in those indices such that they come back up through their resistance levels that they've established right now. And we want to see the small caps, mid caps, begin to outperform the large caps. Interesting aspect to what our comment was earlier on the decline of the dollar and how that would help manufacturing. And I just want to throw this in there for food for thought. I just met with someone that is very well known in financial circles, and they did an analysis of the overall market. And I guess I didn't realize this number, but about 13% of the United States GDP is exported, okay, only 13%. So we have very small, I mean, extremely small relative to other countries, exposure to foreign markets. Whereas you take Germany, and I believe that number was 54%. So Germany has to be much more concerned about what's happening around the globe than the U.S. But in reality, we have very small exposure overseas. The worst that we have to look for is internal weakness in the market. So I just wanted to add that in there. And like I say, going forward, we want to see those reversals in the U.S. markets and take out their resistance levels.
And what about your second factor, is a breakdown in the relative performance of, let's say, defensive sectors, as we mentioned, staples and utilities versus other sectors? What does that tell you? A shift in risk preference, or things are improving?
Exactly. Historically, when we make a market low, what we'll see is we'll see the relative strength performance of staples and utilities reversed against, you know, all of the other sectors that would be considered growth oriented by the market. And that would be everything from consumer discretionary to technology to financials. If we saw those reversals, we'd be much more comfortable about moving from a defensive stance to a constructive stance on the direction of the U.S. markets.
All right, let's move on to, let's say, strength in consumer discretionary, because, you know, the one positive thing about lower oil prices is gasoline prices for consumers have never been this low. At least you'd have to go back 5 or 6 years. So the question is, Dave, I guess a lot of economists are saying they hope that this savings, I read a figure that with the drop in gasoline prices, it's added almost $1,000 to the average consumer's take-home pay. Let's talk about discretionary stocks. You mentioned Coach earlier. Are you seeing some signs, although Coach tends to be more of a luxury item, you know, what about stocks like Walmart, which are breaking down?
Well, Walmart is more of a staple stocks, and what you're seeing in, you know, Walmart certainly looks extremely attractive here. But in essence, it's the store that most people go to in terms of population percentage. It's a great looking chart, but I would consider that more of a staple than a typical retailer because they carry so many groceries. They have a pharmacy. It's a necessity in the economy. And it could also indicate that the middle income portion of the market is actually, you know, starting to go down in terms of what they were seeking in terms of products and finally going into the Walmart to conserve money. You know, there's a lot of studies done, you know, indicating how the lower oil prices have helped everyone. You know, the offset of that, I realize, is that everyone's health care has probably gone up much more than $1,000 this year. So you're switching one for another. And I don't know that that's a study that is, in today's times with escalating health care prices, I don't know if that's a valid view. That's my belief. And I know paying my own health care bill that that's certainly not the case.
I want to talk about financials because last year we spent much of the year talking about the Fed getting ready to raise interest rates. There were a lot of bets made on financials because widening spreads and interest rates are favorable for banks. It improves their profit margins. So a lot of bets were made in that direction. And then, despite the rate increase, all of a sudden those bets were reversed this year as long-term rates came down. There was questions whether the Fed's going to raise in March. So let's talk about strength in the financials because credit moving in the economy is one of the juices to economic growth.
That is correct. You know, it's funny, you know, as little as 6 weeks ago, everyone was concerned about when the next rate hike is. And it seems like every strategist economist, you know, takes the view of forecast off and keep no records. Now the position of most strategists are, what can the Fed do to not raise? Can they lower and can they do another QE? It's amazing how fast we're swinging on a pendulum right now and wondering, you know, are we going to go to the left or the right now? And looking at the higher rates, I think that's great for financials, but not when you have as many defaults out there in terms of the energy and material companies and what their impact on the financials would be. And I think that's what you finally saw in January with the major decline in the financials, is the market realized our economy doesn't appear as healthy as we would like it, and that the Fed really probably has no reason to raise rates and probably didn't have any reason to raise it the first time, especially with no inflation. That's great. They view the market as having great job growth, but without inflation, why are you raising rates? That's one of the things that, you know, the Fed should be looking at.
And I guess it's not just the fact that we're not seeing some real inflation, falling commodity prices, but also we're seeing very anemic economic growth. Dave, as we close here, if I was to sum it up right here, you're basically still heavily more skewed towards defensive sectors, a couple market weight sectors like financials and technology, but pretty much underweight all other sectors. And unless we see these things improve, the reversal of indexes, the breakdown of defensive sectors over, let's say, other sectors in the economy, strength in consumer discretionary, financials, and also stabilization of financial markets, you would probably stay defensive at this point.
I would continue to be on the defensive side and look for individual stocks, you know, making double bottoms, triple bottoms, head and shoulders bottoms. And until I see a great degree of stocks reflecting those patterns, especially in the sectors that we indicated, consumer discretionary, financials, as well as technology. I think it's best to just stay on the sidelines and see where the market takes us.
Well, listen, Dave, as we close, if our listeners would like to find out more about the work that you do at Vermilion Research, tell them how they can do so, please.
Our website is www.vermilioncap.com, 1L in Vermilion. Otherwise, feel free to give us a call at 952-922-7500.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
In case you didn't know it, the Financial Sense News Hour is more than just our weekend show. We also have a weekday program featuring key economic experts, which is only available to our premium members. Here's part of one of the interviews from this last week.
Russell Napier joins us today from Edinburgh, Scotland, and he is the author of Anatomy of the Bear, which has just released fourth edition containing Russell's outlook on the years ahead. And Russell is also the co-founder of the Electronic Research Interchange, or ERIC. Russell, tell us a little bit about this new edition of your book, Anatomy of the Bear, and what you see moving forward in the years ahead.
Sure. The book, when it was written, analyzed four previous great bear market bottoms, and it always purported to be of practical use, something you could use to invest at the bottom. And therefore, in each edition of the book, we've put in a preface, which has some real forecasts and tries to forecast the next few years out and what's coming. And what this one focuses on is the D word, deflation. And one of the conclusions of the book is that deflation is particularly bad for equity valuations. We have had 6 years of extreme monetary policy, but deflation and deleveraging seem to be coming anyway. And what the main part of the book, all the analysis in there, suggests is that equity valuations would fall very quickly. And the problem we have is they're at quite high levels. So it's a fairly pessimistic outlook because it's saying that equities are overvalued and their valuations can fall quickly because it's deflation we have on the horizon coming from many different sources. And I'm sure that's something we'll discuss as we progress.
Well, I'm not dappered or drowsy or ready for sleep because it's time for our commodities report. And Chris Sheridan's with us here. He is host of the FS Insider program, which is heard during the week. And Chris Sheridan, it's yours.
Thanks, John. Greg Weldon is going to be our commodity expert today, and he's looking at the risk coming from the Fed, and we're also going to be discussing what he sees in the oil market, in commodities, with metals, and a wide host of other things. And Greg, I want to ask you the first question is, what are the biggest risks that you see to the market right now?
Well, I think it's the Fed, frankly. I think every other risk kind of extends from the Fed right now. I think that the Fed's hawkish rhetoric leading up to the rate cut, the hawkishness of their forward dot plot projections, and even though those expectations have been, I like to say, they've dove down their dot plot, meaning it's not as hawkish as it was 18 months ago, 24 months ago, when they were expected to take the Fed funds rate to 3.75% by the end of next year. Nonetheless, they're still much more hawkish than the market is. If you look at the futures market, they're pricing in only one more rate cut with 100% certainty by the end of next year. Anything beyond that has much less odds attached to it. So maintaining this thought process and maintaining this stance has kept the dollar fairly well bid, and that has maintained pressure on commodities and made it difficult for emerging markets to have any kind of upside momentum. So it's kind of all on the Fed. External risk, obviously, for me, it's debt. I mean, it's almost as if the levels of sovereign debt have been completely swept under the carpet and no one really wants to talk about it. No one seems to care anymore. You look at what's going on in Europe, pretty much every country has continued to expand their government debt outstanding. In the U.S., we know, I mean, it topped $19 trillion for the first time in January. So this to me is a risk. If the Fed were to actually take rates to where they're projecting they're going to take them, that becomes problematic from the debt issue. So it's very treacherous out there right now. in terms of all that perspective, I think the risk that the Fed is contemplating is the economy itself. And we get a little push up in inflation today. There seems to be some special circumstances involved in that. But man, I'll tell you what, it's never been more treacherous. It's never been more tricky. And the Fed's minutes that were released this week say it all. You need to closely monitor pretty much everything right now, because these things could really swing wildly one way or the other, depending on what exactly central banks do.
Yeah, I want to go back to something that you said, and that's with the risk to debt, because you had in your recent Weldon Live video, you showed what you thought was a pretty ominous chart, and that was looking at, I believe it was Treasury investment capital flows. What's that chart telling you?
Well, it's telling us that foreigners are selling U.S. assets and you have capital outflow. To me, this is highly problematic when you have basically deficits are expanding again. The debt has more than doubled under the current administration in the U.S. The Fed is not only not buying debt, but they're talking about raising interest rates. In all of this, when you have a huge amount of supply that needs to be perpetually refunded and the Fed is not buying, and all of a sudden you remove foreigners who have been a huge buyer of treasuries, that becomes highly problematic in terms of potentially the Fed kind of loses control of the bond market to some degree. And if that were to drive interest rates up, we kind of tie that in with the U.S. government debt outstanding. Then you look at the tick data, the flow of capital in or out of this country. Right now it's flowing out. And then you look at the five-year treasury note, which has come down a lot. It dipped below 1% actually with this most recent rash of stock market weakness. But you have a very well-defined pivot point on the upside in the five-year U.S. treasury note at 190, at 1.90, because that defines the average coupon on the $19 trillion in U.S. debt. Okay, that's the average coupon yield, and the average maturity is 5.4 years. So the bottom line is, if you run the five-year note up through 2%, it's going to be costing you more to roll over debt, and that could become significant. You could be talking about 50% more deficit if you got to, say, 3% on the five-year note yield. And if that comes about because the Fed's not buying, the Fed's talking about raising rates, and if you get any kind of recovery in oil that kind of gives you an impression that inflation is not falling anymore and foreigners are selling, I'm not sure where the buyers are supposed to come from to keep bond yields from rising through the key levels on the upside.
One thing that we keep hearing is that foreigners are viewing U.S. treasuries as a safe haven and buying, given a lot of the concerns we see across the globe. Is that not what you were seeing with the capital outflows?
Well, I mean, you know, that had been true. I mean, there had been some movement into gold and into treasury bonds by foreigners. But what we see now in the data is that the last bout of that came all the way back in November and December. They were net liquidators. It'll be interesting to see what the January data shows. It might show some reversal of that outflow, as you saw stock markets really come under pressure, and emerging markets in particular. So yes, they've been buyers, and that has been a, you know, again, they've been big buyers over the years, and they have been buyers more recently, which is why it seems to me that that's a major risk if they become net sellers. And we've seen periods where the Chinese have been net sellers. And I think if that becomes a kind of a more broadening type of dynamic, it would be a major risk factor. How that plays out with a safe haven view, it's a kind of, again, I mean, you get foreigners buying treasuries, it pushes the dollar up, and that kind of becomes a deflationary dynamic. So I don't know. I really don't know how that plays out going forward. Again, I really think it all kind of pins on the Fed. And this is why all of a sudden meeting minutes become something that you dissect with a fine tooth comb, trying to get some kind of read on what it is the Fed is thinking. And I'll tell you what I have found in the December and now January meeting minutes is much more talk and a change in tone over the dollar. So the Fed is very well aware of these dynamics and how they really don't want to be seen as facilitating another upleg in the dollar, because that would be really kind of continue this downward spiral in terms of commodities and emerging markets, which have so underperformed. Now, that doesn't mean the Fed is in a position to just one step to QE again, QE4. But I think that that extends out towards these countries now, where you have a lot of countries that could actually be easing policy this year. This might be one of the surprises. I mean, you look at what's going on in the UK. The UK 2-year gilt yield fell below the base rate recently. And that's been, in every other instance where that's happened, it's been a sign that they would be cutting rates in the near future. So from that perspective, there may be other bond markets that are more attractive than the U.S. right now. So there's a lot of cross currents. I mean, there really is, in terms of trying to figure out where is money flowing. And at the end of the day, you see it flowing to gold, something that has been completely disinvested. You know, people have completely disinvested from gold. You're sold out across the board. The mining shares, and especially the junior miners, the last time they were this cheap relative to bullions almost 20 years ago, the last time they were this cheap relative to the stock market was almost 20 years ago. And to suggest that that is something that would be sustained is to suggest that the Fed has effectively wiped out all risk. And we know that that's not true. So that money flow, to me, you know, if you have any kind of issue around the U.S. bond market, would only bode well for gold.
Yeah, we did see a very strong move at the beginning of this year. And I think that's been one of the largest ones we've seen so far over the past perhaps 4 or 5 years after it peaked in 2011. I mean, I know we popped well over, I think it was over the 200-day moving average. So it could definitely come back in because it was such a strong and swift move. But that's certainly a very good sign that investors are moving into that area. We've had a number of people come on, Jeff Christian and others, say that they thought that we would see a boomerang effect into gold and perhaps commodities as well, given how short traders were, and that all it took was just one small catalyst and you'd see a pile-on effect. It seems that we did see that in gold recently.
I hate to say this, but I think in this case it was true. It was a pretty easy call for gold. We got bullish more towards the end of last year. You know, you had the one run up towards 1200 and it failed and it came down and made new lows, actually dipped below the 50% retracement of the entire move from 1999 to 2011. You have a 12-year bull market. You had a 4-year, which is 30%. You know, you got all kinds of Fibonacci math going on here in gold. To me, it really keyed off the dollar because the Fed could not allow the dollar to go higher. And you knew they were going to dove down the dot plot. And, you know, if that just kept the dollar at bay, that would open the door for gold. And that's certainly the way it played out. We did our outlook for 2016. And I know that Jim and I had spoken about this the last time I was on. We were quite bullish on gold and it really hadn't yet started to move. Our 2016 outlook came in three pieces. One piece, of course, was on the global financial situation, including, you know, stocks and bonds and the dollar. But the second one of our 2016 outlook themes for this year, we actually had six themes in our three-part outlook, but we dedicated an entire section to gold and the junior miners, that this could be a major turning point for gold, that this would be a really good year for gold or come back into vogue to some degree. And yeah, you had a $200 rally. So, you know, wouldn't be surprised to see a little pullback. You've got people involved to some degree, but nowhere near what it would be to suggest that this is any kind of stopping point, what we've seen here. To me, any dips below 1200 in gold are good buying opportunities.
What are your thoughts on some of the economic data and outlook with regards to the U.S. economy? I know that you look at a lot of fundamentals and macro data. Do you think that there are heightened risks of a recession this year, or do you think the odds of that are pretty low?
I think there is a heightened risk. The things I like to look at, first of all, it seems that one of the things the Fed talked about in their meeting minutes that were just released this week was the stability and the strength in housing. You know, housing starts have been up. Well, I mean, you have a pretty solid 2-month wobble in the housing market, whether it's housing starts, single family starts specifically, whether it's the prospective traffic in the NAHB, the National Association of Home Builders data showed a 7-point decline over the last 2 months. That type of decline in a 2-month period has almost always been a precursor to a recession. So there are a lot of those types of indicators. I very closely watched the prices received component of a lot of the Fed surveys. And when you talk about the Fed has made it very clear. One thing that could change the word transitory, that's a word they like to hype on, that the effects of oil and the deflationary effects are transitory and they will dissipate. It's the exact word they use this time. And by the end of this year, you'll have, you know, a push in inflation. But they're also very much watching inflation expectations and talking about how inflation expectations have been anchored. In other words, people are not becoming more embedded in the thought process that, you know, inflation could actually recede and you could have a disinflation, if not deflationary push, you know, in the mindset of the consumer, in the mindset of businesses. I can tell you that many of the inflation expectations indicators are coming off and coming off hard. We just recently got the Empire State Manufacturing Survey this week. The prices received was negative again. And not only that, but the expectations 6 months from now for prices received, which is a key component to inflation. If you don't have any pricing power, and that comes with wage growth, which you also don't have, you're not going to get a sustainable, healthy ladder of reflation, is what I call it. The prices received expectations component of the Empire State Manufacturing Survey just released posted its lowest level since it was negative in 2009. I did a piece this week called Anchors Away. That's when you pull the anchor out of the ocean and, you know, you take off on your ship. Well, I mean, they're looking to make sure that inflation expectations remain anchored. And right now, they're kind of becoming unanchored. And that is a real problem for the Fed. And that would kind of suggest, if you get that mentality starting to become more embedded in consumers and businesses, again, would be kind of a precursor to some kind of economic downturn.
Greg, what are your thoughts on oil prices? We've had people all over the map on this. Gary Schilling had come on, I think it was last week or a couple weeks ago, and basically said that he's still forecasting oil to reach the $10 to $20 barrel area, which I think that's probably on the low end of most people out there. And then we have others who are thinking, you know, we might see a bounce back into the $50 to $60 range. What are your thoughts in terms of some of the data that you're looking at and tracking on what we might be seeing in the oil market in the weeks and months ahead?
Well, I think the big question is how much of a return to what would be considered normal, you know, 4 million barrels a day or higher production in Iran. You know, you had your little kind of deal with Qatar, Venezuela, Russia, and the Saudis this week to at least begin to discuss trying to cap output. Okay, they're certainly not cutting output. We know Iran's going to produce more. They have to pass on this deal. And it's going to be a question of what kind of output are they going to get agreement on from Russia and the Saudis as to what they can pump. Once we get that, you know, that will remove one uncertainty. But the question is, has that been priced with these low levels? We know there's a supply glut. The dollar has been strong, which has hurt all commodities. So to me, I kind of look at it, well, the supply glut's probably not going to go away anytime soon. From that perspective, I mean, U.S. production is not falling. And that was the whole goal of the Saudis, was to kind of, you know, squeeze the U.S. producer. Well, that hasn't happened. I mean, the companies are getting squeezed, but production remains very high. It's barely off its all-time high, which was set last year. So, you know, there's still plenty of oil. So I don't see this as going back to $60. Could you rally up to 45? Yeah, you could. I kind of see this as maybe a $15 to $20 range developing, where you really don't go anywhere because you're capped by your real fundamentals, you know, supply and demand. You might have a bottom here because the dollar is not going to rally anymore, at least not near term, in my opinion. And that, you know, you have some movement in terms of countries that are hurting. I mean, on the other side, you also have to watch Venezuela very carefully, because to me, this is a whole nother crisis in the making. Black market bolivars threw 1,000 bolivars to the dollar. They just made an official move on their currency to take it from 6.3 to 10. Okay. But the black market rate's 1,000. So it's 100 times where the official rate is. The $100 bolivar note, you know, is not even worth a dime anymore. So I think you have a real problem in Venezuela. That could be a kind of your next little crisis point that is starting to get a little more notice, starting to get a little more discussion. But right now, you know, dollar debt is a big thing out in the world. Venezuela has over $8 billion worth of dollar denominated debt that is coming due within the next 12 months. That's more than half of their official reserves. There's a tipping point out there somewhere for Venezuela. Now, what does that mean for oil? I think it kind of suggests to me it might be something that would be more bullish if you get some kind of problem in Venezuela where it actually causes some kind of unintended output reductions. I mean, PDVSA, their state-owned oil company, their bonds are trading at 25 cents on the dollar right now. That's kind of a wild card factor. To make a long answer shorter, I kind of see some stabilization and some development of a trading range, which we may be trapped in for a while.
It seems like the general consensus from a lot of the traders and technicians and strategists that we talk to is that we are in the midst of a bear market. As we know, most global indices are in bear market territory. So we have seen bear markets around the globe now in the 20% correction area. So at this point, in terms of US markets, the thought is that we're in a bear market trend and that will likely continue, and that we're probably seeing currently a bear market rally, which we saw this week after the major route from the Thursday prior. The question is whether or not we'll be able to move much higher from here, or if this is any type of major bottom we're seeing in the market. I think the major catalysts that are being discussed for where we could see the market head higher is if we were to see a sustainable move higher in oil prices, let's say if OPEC were to actually cut production, and then if Yellen and the Fed were to become increasingly more dovish, if they were to switch their posture from more of a hawkish stance to a dovish stance, or even float a trial balloon about, you know, launching more QE if things get out of hand. Those seem to be the two real big things that traders are looking at for the market to head higher. What are your thoughts on the general trend and where we stand today?
Well, I think, you know, kind of history, or at least the shorter term history of the last bunch of years, would dictate that this has been a buying opportunity. Whenever you kind of dip below the 200-day moving average in the S&P and, you know, it snaps back, you get these little tailed reversals, meaning you're lower and then you close the week higher. Look at the weekly charts in particular for that. But I don't buy it here, because to me, the stock market has been directly and significantly correlated to the Fed's balance sheet. It's not a coincidence that stock market returns tapped out when the Fed went from taper to tap out. The goal of the Fed was to kind of, you know, create a wealth dynamic that allowed consumers to borrow. And in essence, we wrote a piece about a year and a half ago, maybe even 2 years now, that was suggesting the Fed has already kind of laid the groundwork for the next crisis by pumping money into the system. You know, the stock market gets bid up. You had all this capital move out of safe assets into risky assets. That's what the Fed wanted. They got it. And then that allowed the consumers to go on a borrowing spree. Consumer credit has been rising at unprecedented rates, at unbelievable amounts in pure nominal dollars. And that has also been directly and very significantly correlated to the balance sheet of the Fed and to the stock market. So it's different than 2006 and 7 when people were, you know, borrowing against their homes and it was the banks that were exposed. In this case, people have been borrowing against unrealized paper profits in the stock market. And they have continued to borrow even though stocks are no longer going up. Okay, you don't have growth. So to me, that's a problem. And it's a problem, especially if the stock market were to break the lows that we saw recently. Now, what is the impetus to get the market higher? I don't see it. Okay, because the impetus, you know, since 2009 has been QE. You don't have QE now. The economy's on its own and it's wobbling. You know, we're not sure. It's like a newborn horse. I mean, it's kind of wobbly on its legs. To me, that's kind of where the economy is right now. So I think the Fed needs to be taken to task. I mean, the markets are what drives things. And the Fed is not going to break out QE here. The Fed would only break out QE if the stock market got whacked again. And I think that's what's going to happen. I think that the lows here, 18-20 on the S&P, you got a double bottom of tailed reversals at that level. It's not only, you know, just near term, but has long term technical implications that are real significant. You break those lows, and this is a real technical issue in terms of, you know, how quickly and how far this market might be exposed on the downside. So I think right now, like the Fed says, the risk is kind of skewing to the downside in the economy. I think the risk is very much skewed to the downside in the stock market, and that being a potential catalyst to bring the Fed back into play. And trust me, I'm not saying that that's the right thing, that the Fed should do more QE, or that's the right thing to do. It never was the right thing to do. You know, from that academic perspective, you know, the time to do the right thing, the last chance we had to do the right thing was in 1990, and we didn't do it. So ever since then, it's only about pain avoidance. It's not about right or wrong and what's academically correct solution to these problems. No, it's about a debt deflation would be so catastrophic, they have to make sure they avoid it, and they will do whatever they have to try and avoid it. One more point I'll make, though. Bigger picture is, you know, what happens the day they're bringing out QE, like we kind of just saw in Europe, and it disappoints? You know, you can't have balance sheets. I mean, balance sheet in Japan, the slope is almost parabolic. It's almost straight up and down. I mean, at some point, this stops working. And that's the day of reckoning that a lot of the gloom and doomers talk about. It's out there. I think we got a couple steps till we get there. I think there's another round of QE that may be successful. But how do we get there? The Fed is already saying we're going to raise interest rates. You can't just turn around and pump out QE. It's going to be a two-step, if not three-step process. And in the interim, I think the stock market is very much at risk.
Well, and you mentioned the diminishing effects that we see from central banking policy. I mean, Japan went negative, and that was fairly short-lasting, I understand, with the effects from that. And of course, we know with quantitative easing, that is going to be reflating asset prices. Perhaps some of the downside risks of that are a bit more muted, but with negative interest rates, the downside risks or the collateral damage from negative interest rates are pretty clear. Right? I mean, in terms of pension funds, in terms of banks, in terms of the insurance industry, right? So they all start running into trouble in that case once you move into negative territory.
No doubt. I mean, it's pretty simple. You don't have to be a rocket scientist to kind of look at this. Even a, you know, mom, pa kettle out there, Mr. Layman, can say, hey, negative interest rates, it can't be good for the banks. You know, I mean, obviously you're trying to get banks to lend, but as the situation in Japan has shown us, you can cut the cost of money. You can't create demand for it just out of thin air. So this is a problem going forward in terms of, you know, negative rates. And what if they don't work? And what if they have the unintended consequences that are more negative than the positives that it might foster in terms of borrowing, in terms of, I mean, this is, again, what central banks are trying to do is force money into riskier assets. And you just can't do that forever and get away with it. So, yeah, there are some potential unintended consequences and are very much watching the Japanese bank stocks in particular, because Japan is kind of like your little litmus test now for this and to see how the banks deal with it. It was interesting. They made it a three-tier system. So they're not applying negative rates to money already on deposit. It's only new money. So that was an interesting little twist, but that's not going to be enough to potentially, you know, squelch what could be negative impacts for bank earnings. To me, I mean, it's almost, maybe it's too simple, you know, to say that, but to me, it seems pretty straightforward.
Well, Greg, I know that you are tracking a lot of the things that we discussed today on a regular basis through your Weldon Live videos. If anyone in our audience wanted to get their hands on those videos and some of your other work, what would be the best way to do so?
Best way to do so is very simply go to our website, www.weldononline.com. And that's one word, W-E-L-D-O-N, weldononline.com. Any of your listeners are more than welcome, if they've never had a trial, at least, to come and sign up for a free 30-day trial to any of our channels. We have 7 channels, Global Macros, one of them, Fixed Income, Foreign Exchange, Stock Index ETF channel, Metals, Energy, and the Ag. So we cover everything. And we have specific trading strategies that are offered in all of the sectors that come with the channels. So, you know, and our Outlook 2016 is also still available. You know, feel free to go to the website and sign up, or go to the website and shoot us an email and we'll set you up and send you a password.
If you have listened to this program for any length of time, you know that we have been staunch advocates of dividend-paying stocks, especially blue-chip dividend-paying stocks, as a strategy for having a stream of income which is relatively stable and secure. Are we still that way? Well, the answer is yes. But given the changes that are going on in the market, we have some caveats to that. You have to be careful what dividend-paying stocks you invest in. That'll be part of the big picture discussion coming up next year on the Financial Sense NewsHour. And it's no secret that we're in the middle of a silly season. That's our presidential election campaign. And with all of the claims and counterclaims being made by politicians about what they want to do with everybody else's money, is it really any wonder that the markets are nervous and jittery this year? I mean, there are other things to be nervous and jittery about, but we'll take a look at the effect that the election is having as far as extreme outcomes regarding the markets and investments. All of that coming up next on The Big Picture as the Financial Sense NewsHour continues at financialsense.com.